Markets are bad, markets are good. Michael I. Norton, Associate Professor of Business Administration, Marketing Unit, Harvard Business School. Co-author with Elizabeth Dunn, Happy Money. Markets can have terrible consequences. Take just one example. In an ingenious experiment, researchers showed that people who entered a market where livestock were priced as commodities were more likely to devalue the lives of those animals, treating those lives as nothing more than opportunities for profit. Markets can have uplifting consequences. Take just one example. In a series of investigations, researchers showed that efficient markets have contributed to the development of countless life-saving drugs, albeit sometimes with a little governmental help, bettering the lives of billions. Yet, in popular and scientific discourse, it's uncommon to see markets described as anything except evil and fundamentally flawed, left-leaning pundits and scholars, or perfect and self-correcting, right-leaning pundits and scholars. It's time to retire both theories. Taking a step back and seeing markets as they are, an aggregation of many individuals, shows them as unlikely to be good or bad. Replace the word markets with another shorthand term for an aggregation of individuals, groups. We don't view groups as good or bad. Groups are capable of amazing selflessness, generosity, and heroism. They're also capable of selfishness, greed, and cruelty. They're capable of amazing performance. Think of Bell Labs. They're also capable of terrible performance. Think of the many dysfunctional groups of which you've been a member. When we think of groups, we think of the conditions under which they're likely to behave well or poorly. We don't often think of them as self-correcting or always performing well over time, or, most important, as either inherently good or inherently bad. Applying the same logic to markets will help us develop a richer and more accurate theory of when and why they're likely to have terrible or uplifting consequences. Stationarity. Giulio Boccaletti, physicist, atmospheric and oceanic scientist, managing director, The Nature Conservancy. When the ancient capital of the Nabataeans, Petra, was rediscovered by Johann Burckhardt in the early 1800s, it might have seemed unthinkable that anybody could have lived in such an arid place. Yet at its peak in the first century BCE, Petra was the center of a powerful trading empire and home to up to 30,000 people. Petra's very existence was a testament to how water management could support the development of civilization in extreme circumstances. This part of the world, today in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, survives on less than 70 millimeters of rain a year, much of it concentrated in a few events in the rainy season. The climate 2,000 years ago was similar, yet Petra thrived, thanks to a system of rock-cut underground cisterns, terraced slopes, dams, and aqueducts, which stored and delivered water from springs and runoff flows. Petra could grow food, provide drinking water, and support a bustling city because of that infrastructure. This story is not dissimilar from that of many other places across the world today. The western United States, northern China, South Africa, the Punjab, such areas have thrived and grown thanks to human ingenuity and water engineering, allowing people to overcome the adversity of a difficult, at times impossible, hydrology. Whether the Nabataean engineers knew it or not, to deliver reliable water infrastructure, they relied, like all water engineers since, on two commonly assumed properties of hydrological events: stationarity and, rather more esoterically, ergodicity. Both concepts have well-defined mathematical meaning. Simply put, though, stationarity implies that the probability distribution of a random event is independent of time, and a stationary process is ergodic if, given a sufficiently long time, it will realize most of the universe of options available to it. Practically, this lets us assume that if we have observed an event for long enough, will also probably have witnessed enough of its behavior to represent the underlying distribution function at any given point in time. In the case of hydrology, stationarity lets us define events by using time statistics, like the 1 in 100 years flood. The assumption that hydrology can be represented by such stationary processes enables the design of infrastructure whose behavior can be known well into the future. After all, such water infrastructures as dams, levees, and so on last for decades, even centuries, so it's important that they be constructed to withstand most predictable events. This is what allowed Nabataean, Chinese, American, South African, and Indian water engineers to design water systems they could legitimately rely on. And those systems have been successful, so far. Stationarity provides a convenient, simplifying gambit. That plans for future water management can be based on an appropriately long historical time series of past hydrology, because the past is simply a representative sequence of realizations of a roughly fixed probability distribution. But in the real world, where there's no counterfactual and a single experiment is running all the time, such assumptions are true only until proved wrong. We're now realizing that they are, in fact, wrong. Not just theoretically wrong, but practically flawed. A growing number of recent observations support the idea that probability distributions we assumed were fixed are not. They're changing, and changing fast. Many of what used to be 1 in 100 year events are more likely to be 1 in 20 year events. Droughts, once considered extreme and unlikely, are now much more common. Accelerating changes in climate, coupled with a more sensitive global economy in which more people and more value is at stake, reveal that we don't live in a world as stationary as we thought. And infrastructure designed for that world and intended to last for decades is proving increasingly inadequate. The implications are monumental for our relationship with the planet and its water resources. A broadly stationary environment can be engineered away. Someone will take care of it as long as we can define what we need and have enough resources to pay for it. Things are different in a non-stationary world. The problem of water management is no longer decoupled from the dynamics of climate, as the climate is no longer constant on practical timescales. We face unforeseen variability. The past is no longer necessarily a guide to the future, and we cannot simply rely on someone taking care of it. It is no longer just an engineering problem. Climatology, hydrology, ecology, and engineering all become relevant instruments in the management of a dynamic problem whose nature requires adaptability and resilience. Our own economy should be prepared to adapt, because no long-term piece of infrastructure can be expected to manage what it was not designed for. By the 1st century CE, the Nabataeans had been incorporated into the Roman Empire, and over subsequent centuries their civilization withered away, the victim of changing trade routes and shifting geopolitics, and proof that while water can support the development of civilizations, it's far from sufficient to see them thrive. Today we have hundreds of cities around the world that, just like Petra, rely on engineered water infrastructure to support their growth. From Los Angeles to Beijing, from Phoenix to Istanbul, great cities of the world depend on a reliable source of water in the face of unreliable hydrology. If stationarity is indeed a thing of the past, water management is no longer a white coat's business, something that can be taken care of in the background. We must consider choices, have contingency plans for events we might not have experienced, and realize that we might get it wrong. We must go from managing water to managing risk. Stationarity. Lawrence C. Smith, Professor and Chair of Geography, Professor of Earth and Space Sciences, UCLA. Author, The World in 2050, Four Forces Shaping Civilization's Northern Future. Stationarity, the assumption that natural world phenomena fluctuate with a fixed envelope of statistical uncertainty that doesn't change over time, is a widely applied scientific concept that's ready to be retired. It had a good run. For more than a century, stationarity has been used to inform countless decisions aimed at the public good. It guides the planning and building codes for places susceptible to wildfires, floods, earthquakes, and hurricanes. It's used to determine how and where homes may be built, the structural strength of bridges, and how much premium people should pay for their homeowners' insurance policies. Crop yields are forecasted and, in the developed world, insured against catastrophic failures. And as more weather stations and river level gauges are built and accumulate ever longer data records, our abilities to make such calculations get better. This saves lives and a great deal of money. But a growing body of research shows that stationarity is often the exception, not the norm. As new satellite technologies scan the Earth, as more geological records are drilled, and as the instrument records lengthen, they commonly reveal patterns and structures inconsistent with a fixed envelope of random noise. Instead, there are transitions to various quasi-stable states, each characterized by a different set of physical conditions and associated statistical properties. In climate science, for example, we have discovered multi-decadal patterns, like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, an El Niño-like phenomenon in the North Pacific, triggering far-reaching changes in climate averages that persist for decades. In the 20th century, for example, the PDO experienced warm phases in 1922 through 1946 and 1977 through 1998, and a cool phase in 1947 through 1976, with significant effects on water resources and fisheries. And anthropogenic climate change, induced by our steady ramping up of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, is by definition the opposite of a fixed, stationary process. This imperils the basis of many societal risk calculations, because as the statistical probabilities of the past break down, we enter a world that operates outside of expected and understood norms. This recognition is not new among scientists, but has been surprisingly slow to penetrate the practical world. For example, even as awareness and acceptance of climate change has grown, stationarity continues to serve as the default assumption in water resource risk assessment and planning. Floodplain zoning continues to be designed around stationary concepts like the 100 and 500-year flood, despite known impacts of land use, conversion, and urbanization on water runoff and the anticipated impacts of anthropogenic climate change. The civil engineering profession and most regulatory agencies around the world have been slow to acknowledge these changes and seek new approaches to address them. But viable alternatives exist. For example, using the precautionary no-regrets probable maximum flood, PMF, method to design dams and bridges, and incorporation of more flexible subjectivist Bayesian probabilities in societal risk calculations. We can do better. Stationarity is dead, especially for our understanding of the world's water, food security, and climate. The Carbon Footprint. Daniel Goleman, psychologist. Author, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. Buy potato chips in London, and a number on the bag will tell you that its carbon footprint equals 75 grams of carbon emissions. That label serves two excellent functions. It renders transparent the ecological impact of those chips and lowers the cognitive cost to zero of learning that impact. Such carbon footprint ratings, in theory, allow shoppers to favor products with better impacts and companies to do the same with their operations. Well and good. Except that the footprint concept, intended to mobilize the mass changes we need, ignores fundamentals of human motivation, tending to stifle change, not encourage it. It's time we moved beyond talking about carbon footprints, replacing the concept with a more precise measure of all the negative effects of a given human activity on planetary systems for sustaining life. And while we're at it, let's go easy on the very idea of any kind of footprint. The numbers are demoralizing. There's a more motivating replacement waiting in the wings. Handprint. First, the expanded footprint. While the dialogue on global warming and its remedies focuses tightly on the carbon impact of our activities and energy systems as measured by their carbon footprint, this focus skews the conversation. Technically, a carbon footprint represents the total global warming effect of greenhouse gas emissions from a given activity, system, or product. While carbon dioxide is the poster child for greenhouse gases, other such gases include methane, nitrous oxide, and ozone, not to mention vaporized water or the condensed form, clouds. To create a standard unit for greenhouse gas effects, all these varieties of emissions are converted into a carbon dioxide equivalent. Reasonable, but this doesn't go far enough. Why stop with carbon? There are several planet-wide systems that maintain life. Climate change is but one of myriad ways that human activity harms the planet. There's ecosystem destruction, dead lakes and ocean from acidification, loss of biodiversity, nitrogen and phosphorus cycles, dangers from particulate load in air, water, and soil, pollution from man-made chemicals, and more. All these problems arise because virtually all human systems for energy, transportation, construction, industry, and commerce are built on platforms that degrade those global systems. Calculating the overall ecological footprint of a given activity offers a more fine-tuned metric for the rate at which we're depleting all the global systems sustaining life on the planet, not just the carbon cycle. Such metrics emerged from the relatively new science of industrial ecology, an amalgam of hard sciences like physics, chemistry, and biology, with practical applications like industrial engineering and industrial design. This eco-math helps us perceive effects we're otherwise oblivious to. For instance, when industrial ecologists measure how much of the carbon footprint you remediate when you recycle the plastic yogurt container, the result is about 5% of the yogurt's carbon footprint. Most of the yogurt's carbon footprint results from the methane emitted by digesting cattle, not from the plastic container. Second, there's the motivational problem. Evolution shaped the human brain to help our ancestors survive in an era when the salient threats were predators. Our perceptual system was not tuned to the macro and micro changes that signal threats to the planetary support system. When it comes to these threats, we suffer from system blindness. While footprints offer a cognitive workaround that can help us make decisions favoring the planet, they too often have an unfortunate psychological effect. Knowing the planetary damage we do can be depressing and demotivating. Negative messages like this, research from fields like public health finds, lead many or most people to tune out. Better to give us something positive we can do than to shame or scare us. Enter the handprint. The sum total of all the ways we lower our footprint. To calculate a handprint, take the footprint as the baseline and then go a step further. Assess the amount ameliorated by the good things we do. Recycle, reuse, bike instead of drive. Convince other people to do likewise. Or invent a replacement for a high footprint technology, like the styrofoam substitute made from rice hulls and mycelium rather than petroleum. The handprint calculation applies the same methodology as for footprints, but reframes the total as a positive value. Keep growing your handprint and you're steadily reducing your negative effect on the planet. Make your handprint bigger than your footprint and you're sustaining the planet not damaging it. Such a positive spin, motivational research tells us, will be more likely to keep people moving toward the target. Unbridled Scientific and Technological Optimism. Stuart Pym, Doris Duke Chair of Conservation Ecology, Duke University. Author, A Scientist Audits the Earth. Science and technology have made such spectacular improvements to our lives that it seems churlish to whinge about them. I understand the benefits better than most. My fieldwork is where the other half lives, the majority of the world's population too poor to have access to safe drinking water, antibiotics, and much, if any, electricity. I can go home, flip a switch, turn on the tap, and carry Cipro wherever I go. Just as natural selection picks past winners but brutally trims most mutations, so the science we love does not make every scientist in a white lab coat a hero. Many proposed scientific advances are narrow in their benefits, poorly thought out in the long term, and attention-getting or venally self-serving. Worst of all, optimism creates a moral hazard. When science promises it can fix everything, why worry about breaking things? For example, discussions about fracking and the supplies of cheap fossil fuels it may give us pit the local, near-term threats of a new technology against obvious benefits. For the United States, the energy is here and not in some politically sketchy country that requires vast military adventures to defend or to invade. For surely we would not have invaded Iraq if its principal export had been cantaloupes. So, bravo for fracking? Hardly. Suppose this, or any fossil fuel, were cheap and environmentally entirely free of local concerns. It would further accelerate global carbon emissions and their increasingly serious consequences. Perversely, the better, cleaner, cheaper, faster the technology, the worse the eventual problem of too much atmospheric carbon dioxide. Surely decades of cheap gas give us breathing space to develop and transition to sustainable energies? That's a gamble with disastrous consequences to our planet if we fail. Won't new technologies soak up the carbon for us, allowing fossil fuels free rein? Only in the minds of those who seek huge research funds to pursue their ideas. The best and cheapest technology is what we ecologists call trees. Burning them contributes about 15% of the global carbon emissions, so reducing those, as Brazil has done so successfully in recent years, is altogether a good idea. Restoring deforested areas is also prudent and economical. Trees have been around since the Devonian. Of the many dire effects of a much hotter planet, the irreversible losses are to biodiversity. Species extinction rates already run 1,000 times higher than normal. Climate disruption will inflate them further. Optimists have the answer. The purest hubris is to raise the dead. De-extinction seeks to resurrect individual extinct species, usually charismatic ones. You know the plot. In the movie Jurassic Park, a tree extinct for millions of years delights the paleobotanist. Then a sauropod eats its leaves. We then learn how to recreate the animal itself. The movie is curiously silent on how to grow the tree, which at that size would be perhaps 100 or more years old, metaphorically overnight. To sustain a single sauropod, one would need thousands of trees of many species, as well as their pollinators and perhaps their essential symbiotic fungi. Millions of species risk extinction. De-extinction can be only an infinitesimal part of solving the crisis that now sees species of animals, some large but mostly tiny, plants, fungi, and microbes going extinct at 1,000 times their natural rates. Proponents of de-extinction claim they want only to resurrect passenger pigeons and the Pyrenean ibex, not dinosaurs. They assume that the plants on which these animals depended survive, so there's no need to resurrect them as well. Indeed, botanic gardens worldwide have living collections of an impressively large fraction of the world's plants, some extinct in the wild, others soon to be so. Their absence from the wild is thus more easily fixed than the absence of animals for which optimists tout de-extinction. Perhaps so, but other practical problems abound. A resurrected Pyrenean ibex will need a safe home, not just its food plants. For those of us who attempt to reintroduce zoo-bred species that have gone extinct in the wild, one question tops the list. Where do we put them? Hunters ate this wild goat to extinction. Reintroduce a resurrected ibex to where it belongs, and it will quickly become the most expensive cabrito ever eaten. De-extinction is much worse than a waste. It sets up the expectation that biotechnology can repair the damage we're doing to the planet's biodiversity. Fantasies of reclaiming extinct species are always seductive. Real scientists wearing white lab coats use fancy machines with knobs and digital readouts to save the planet from humanity's excesses. There's none of the messy interactions with people, politics, and economics that characterize my world. There's nothing involving the real-world realities of habitat destruction, of the inherent conflict between increasing human populations and wildlife survival. Why worry about endangered species? We can simply keep their DNA and put them back in the wild later. When I testify before Congress on endangered species, I'm always asked, can't we safely reduce the spotted owl to small numbers, keeping some in captivity as insurance? The meaning is clear. Let's log out almost all of Western North America's old-growth forests, because if we can save species with high-tech solutions, the forest doesn't matter. Let's tolerate a high risk of extinction. Conservation is about the ecosystems that species define and on which they depend. It's about finding alternative, sustainable futures for peoples, for forests, and for wetlands. Molecular gimmetry does not address these core problems. We shouldn't limit science. I, too, celebrate its successes. The idea we should retire is that new, technically clever solutions suffice to fix our world. Common sense is necessary.
Scientists should stick to science. Budini Samarasinghe, molecular biologist. It's a statistical fact that you're more likely to die while horseback riding, one serious adverse event every 350 or so exposures, than from taking ecstasy, one serious adverse event every 10,000 or so exposures. Yet in 2009, the scientist who said this was fired from his position as chairman of the UK's Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. Professor David Nutt's remit was to make scientific recommendations to government ministers on the classification of illegal drugs based on the harm they can cause. He was dismissed because his statement highlighted how the UK government's policies on narcotics are at odds with scientific evidence. Today, the medical use of drugs such as cannabis remains technically illegal. Such incidents of silencing are sadly commonplace when it comes to politically controversial scientific topics. The U.S. government muzzled climate scientists in a similar manner in 2007, when it was reported that 46% of 1,600 surveyed scientists were warned against using terms like global warming, and 43% said their published work had been revised in ways that altered their conclusions. U.S. preparations for oncoming climate change were blocked as a result, a failing that persists today. Going back further, the story of Nikolai Vavilov is chilling. Vavilov was a plant geneticist in the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin. He was jailed in 1940 for criticizing the pseudoscientific views of Trofim Lysenko, a protege of Stalin. Vavilov died of starvation in prison a few years later. Scientific dissent from Lysenko's theories of Lamarckian inheritance was outlawed in 1948. Soviet agriculture languished for decades because of Lysenkoism. Meanwhile, famine decimated the population. The scientific method is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as a method or procedure consisting in systematic observation, measurement, and experiment, and the formulation, testing, and modification of hypotheses. It's our finest instrument for unearthing the truth. Applied correctly, it's blind to and corrects for our inherent biases. Scientists are trained to wield this formidable tool in their quest to understand the universe around us. The truths they uncover can be at odds with our current beliefs, but when the facts, based on evidence and arrived at through rigorous testing, change, minds also need to change. I use the examples of sidelined scientists to illustrate the consequences of excluding science from the policymaking process. But sometimes the sidelining is self-imposed. Scientists can be genuinely reluctant to get involved in such activity and instead prefer to focus on gathering data and publishing results. There's a tacit understanding, a custom in the culture of science, that scientists practice the scientific method in the confines of the ivory tower. Scientists are seen as impartial, aloof individuals with a single-minded focus on their work and out of touch with the realities of the world around them. They're expected to only do science, to find the truth, and then leave it up to everyone else to decide what to do with it. This is untenable. Scientists have a moral obligation to engage with the public about their findings, to advise and speak out on policy and critique its implementation. Science affects the life of every single species on our planet. It's ludicrous that the very people who discover the facts are not part of any subsequent policymaking dialogue. Science needs to be an essential component of the public discourse. Currently, it is not. The consequences of that disconnect can be dire, as evidenced by the criminalization of drugs that can provide relief to sufferers of chronic pain, troubling delays in programs of vital national importance, and the famine that slaughtered millions of Soviet citizens under Stalin's regime. Scientists shouldn't simply stick to doing science. Perhaps we need to extend the scientific method to include a requirement for communication. Young scientists should be taught the value and necessity of communicating their findings to the general public. Scientists shouldn't shy away from controversy, because some topics shouldn't be controversial to begin with. The scientific evidence for the efficacy of vaccines, the process of evolution, the existence of anthropogenic climate change, all are accepted in the scientific community. Yet within the public sphere, goaded by a sensationalizing mainstream media and politicians seeking re-election, these settled facts are made to appear tentative. Science is based on evidence, and if that evidence tells us something new, we need to incorporate that into our policies. We cannot ignore it simply because it's unpopular or inconvenient. By passionately advocating for evidence-based policy, scientists will expand scientific research, reversing the trend of recent years, and by thus visibly working for the common weal, they will earn the public's trust, protecting long-term investigations from short-sighted cuts. Scientific advancement is dependent on public funding and public backing. The space race, the Human Genome Project, the search for the Higgs boson, and the Mars Curiosity rover mission were all enthusiastically embraced by the public. The progress of science demands that scientists engage the public. But for that to happen, the notion that a scientist should stay hidden away in a laboratory needs to be retired.
Nature equals objects. Scott Sampson, Vice President of Research and Collections, Denver Museum of Nature and Science, dinosaur paleontologist, author, Dinosaur Odyssey. One of the most prevalent ideas in science is that nature consists of objects. Of course, the very practice of science is grounded in objectivity. We objectify nature so that we can measure it, test it, and study it, with the ultimate goal of unraveling its secrets. Doing so typically requires reducing natural phenomena to their component parts. Most zoologists, for example, think of animals in terms of genes, physiologies, species, and the like. Yet this pervasive, centuries-old trend toward reductionism and objectification tends to prevent us from seeing nature as subjects, though there's no science to support such myopia. On the contrary, to give just one example, perhaps the deepest lesson cascading from Darwin's contributions is that all life on Earth, including us, arose from a single family tree. To date, however, this intellectual insight has yet to penetrate our hearts. Even those of us who fully embrace the notion of organic evolution tend to regard nature as resources to be exploited rather than relatives deserving of our respect. What if science were to conceive of nature as both object and subject? Would we need to abandon our cherished objectivity? Of course not. Despite their chosen field of study, the vast bulk of social scientists don't struggle to form emotional bonds with family and friends. More so than at any point in the history of science, it's time to extend this subject-object duality to at least the non-human life forms with which we share this world. Why? Because much of our unsustainable behavior can be traced to a broken relationship with nature, a perspective that treats the non-human world as a realm of mindless, unfeeling objects. Sustainability will almost certainly depend on developing mutually enhancing relations between humans and non-human nature. Yet why would we foster such sustainable relations unless we cared about the natural world? An alternate worldview is called for, one that reanimates the world. This mind shift, in turn, requires no less than the subjectification of nature. The notion of nature as subjects is not new. Indigenous peoples around the globe tend to view themselves as embedded in animate landscapes replete with relatives. We have much to learn from this ancient wisdom. To objectify is to interiorize, such that the exterior world interpenetrates our interior world. Whereas the relationships we share with subjects often tap into our hearts, objects are dead to our emotions. Finding ourselves in relationships, the boundaries of self can become permeable and blurred. Many of us have experienced such transcendent feelings during interactions with non-human nature, from pets to forests. But how might we undertake such a grand subjectification of nature? After all, worldviews become deeply ingrained. They're like the air we breathe, essential but ignored. Part of the answer is likely to be found in the practice of science itself. The reductionist Western scientific tradition has concentrated on the nature of substance, asking, what is it made of? Yet a parallel approach, also operating for centuries though often in the background, has investigated the science of pattern and form. Generally tied to Leonardo da Vinci, the latter method has sought to explore relationships, which can be notoriously difficult to quantify and must instead be mapped. The science of patterns has seen a recent resurgence, with abundant attention directed toward such fields as ecology and complex adaptive systems. Yet we've only scratched the surface, and much more integrative work remains to be done that could help us understand relationships. Another part of the answer is to be found in education. We need to raise our children so that they see the world with new eyes. At the risk of heresy, I'd argue that science education in particular could be reinvigorated with subjectification in mind. Certainly the practice of science, the actual doing of scientific research, must be as objective as possible. But the communication of science could be done using both objective and subjective lenses. Imagine if the bulk of science education took place outdoors, in direct, multi-sensory contact with the natural world. Imagine if students were encouraged to develop a meaningful sense of place through an understanding of the deep history and ecological workings of that place. And imagine if mentors and educators emphasized not only the identification and functioning of parts, say of flowers or insects, but also the notion of organisms as sensate beings in intimate relationships with one another and us. What if students were asked to spend more time learning about how a particular plant or animal experiences its world? In this way, science, and biology in particular, could help bridge the chasm between humans and nature. Ultimately, science education, in concert with other areas of learning, could go a long way toward achieving the great work described by cultural historian Thomas Berry, transforming the perceived world from a collection of objects to a communion of subjects. Scientific Morality. Edward Slingerland, Professor of Asian Studies, Canada Research Chair in Chinese Thought and Embodied Cognition, University of British Columbia. Author, Trying Not to Try. Impressed by the growing explanatory power of the natural sciences of his time, the philosopher David Hume called on his colleagues to abandon the armchair, turn their attention to empirical evidence, and hearken to no arguments but those which are derived from experience, to reject every system of ethics, however subtle or ingenious, which is not founded on fact and observation. This was more than 250 years ago, and unfortunately not much changed in academic philosophy until about the last decade or two. Pushing past a barrier also associated with Hume, the infamous is-ought or fact-value distinction, a growing number of philosophers have finally begun arguing that our theories should be informed by our best current empirical accounts of how the human mind works, and that an ethical system that posits or requires an impossible psychology should be treated with suspicion. One of the more robust and relevant bits of knowledge about human psychology that has emerged from the cognitive sciences is that we're not rational minds housed in irrational emotional bodies. Metaphors like that of Plato's rational charioteer bravely struggling to control his irrational, passionate horses appeal to us because they map well onto our intuitive psychology, but they turn out to be ultimately misleading. A more empirically accurate image would be that of a centaur. Rider and horse are one. To the best of our knowledge, there's no ghost in the machine. We're thoroughly embodied creatures, embedded in a complex social and culturally shaped environment, primarily guided in our daily lives not by cold calculation, but hot emotion, not conscious choice, but automatic spontaneous processes, not rational concepts descended from the realm of forms, but modal, analogical images. So, the ironic result of adopting a scientific stance toward human morality is to lay bare the impossibility of a purely scientific morality. The thoroughly rational, evidence-guided utilitarian is as much of a myth as the elusive Homo economicus, and equally as worthy of our disdain. Evolution may be utilitarian, guided solely by considerations of costs and benefits, but the ruthlessly utilitarian process of biocultural evolution has produced organisms that are, at approximate level, incapable of functioning in a completely utilitarian fashion, and for very good design reasons. Because of rational evolutionary considerations, we cannot help but react irrationally to unfair offers in the ultimatum game, challenges to our honor, or perceived threat to our loved ones or cherished ideals. We're culturally infused animals, guided largely by automatic habits, barely conscious hunches, profoundly motivating emotions, and wholehearted commitment to spooky, non-empirical entities ranging from human rights to the Word of God to the coming proletarian utopia. Science is powerful and important because it represents a set of institutional practices and thinking tools that allow us, qua scientists or intellectuals, to bootstrap ourselves out of our immediate perceptions and proximate psychology. We can understand that the Earth goes around the Sun, that wonderful design can be the product of a blind watchmaker, or that the human mind is, in an important sense, reducible to biological processes. This gives us some helpful leverage over our evolved psychology, and I join many in thinking that this more accurate knowledge about ourselves and our world might allow us to devise and maybe embrace novel ethical commitments that could lead to more satisfying lives and a more just world. But let's not lose sight of the fact that science cannot bootstrap us out of our evolved minds themselves. The desire to bring about a more equitable, fair, and peaceful world is itself an emotion, an ultimately irrational drive grounded in commitment to ideals like human dignity, freedom, and well-being, which we have inherited in stripped-down, theologically minimalist form from the cultural religious traditions into which we were born. In their latest liberal iterations, these ideals are rather odd. Very few cultures have embraced diversity and tolerance as ethical desiderata, for instance, and are far from being universally embraced even in our contemporary world. So the myth that we secular liberals have emerged into a neutral place where we stand freed of all belief and superstition, guided solely by rationality, evidence, and clearly perceived self-interest, is something that needs to be retired. It's simply not the case that secular liberalism, grounded in materialist utilitarianism, is the inevitable and default worldview of anyone who isn't stupid, brainwashed, or uneducated. This idea seriously impedes our ability to understand people in earlier historical periods from other cultures, and even ourselves. Acknowledging that doesn't entail wallowing in postmodern relativism or blindly marching to a fundamentalist beat. Scientific inquiry, in its broad sense, is so effective at giving us reliable information about the world that to seriously defend any other method of inquiry as superior or even equal is perverse. There's also arguably a pragmatic case to be made that secular liberalism is the best worldview humans have ever come up with, or at least that individuals, given a choice, tend to preferentially gravitate toward it. In any case, it's our value system, and the very nature of evolved human psychology makes it impossible for us not to want to defend human dignity or women's rights and, when appropriate, impose them on others. But recognizing the limitations of reason allows us to articulate and defend such values in a more effective way. It also allows us to better understand scientifically problems such as the causes of religious violence or the roots of persistent international conflicts, or moral challenges such as balancing our folk intuitions about personal responsibility with a neuroscientific understanding of free will. The science of morality requires us to, in the end, get beyond the myth of a perfectly objective, scientific morality. Science is self-correcting. Alex Holcomb, Associate Professor of Psychology, University of Sydney, Co-Director, Center for Time, Associate Editor, Perspectives on Psychological Science. The pace of scientific production has quickened, and self-correction has suffered. Findings that might correct old results are considered less interesting than results for more original research questions. Potential corrections are also more contested. As the competition for space in prestigious journals has become increasingly frenzied, doing and publishing studies that would confirm the rapidly accumulating new discoveries, or would correct them, has become a losing proposition. Publication bias is the tendency to not publish negative or non-confirmatory results. Its effect, the suppression of corrections, can prevail even when much work has gone into obtaining the negative results. Ideally, such findings would move quickly and easily from individual scientists' laboratories to public availability. But the path can be so difficult and is so infrequently used that many areas of science don't deserve the self-correcting moniker. The prestigious journals in many fields make no bones about it, declaring that they're in the business of publishing exciting discoveries that advance the field in new ways, not studies similar to previous ones which find a less interesting result. Even at those journals claiming to welcome negative findings, a would-be corrector faces an uphill battle. The scientists who vet the new evidence for the journal typically include the author or authors of the original and possibly incorrect conclusion. Human frailty, egotism, and anonymity together bias reviewers' verdicts toward reject. That's normally enough to deny new negative results an appearance in a journal. Self-correction is thus undermined by several factors, some human and some institutional. The institutional factors are sometimes historical accidents. One is the number of venues where it's considered appropriate to publish your work. In certain subfields, almost all new work appears in only a very few journals, all associated with a single professional society. There's no way around the senior gatekeepers, who can suppress corrections with impunity. Fields with a variety of publication venues and stakeholders are healthier. It's more difficult for a single school of thought to take over. Several fields, such as astrophysics, have a culture of sharing and citing manuscripts before they're even submitted to journals. Researchers need only post their manuscript to a website, such as archive.org. The result reported might then be ignored, but cannot be fully suppressed. In principle, all areas of science could adopt this practice, but for now most stick with their secretive reviews, which frequently torpedo new results. The bias against corrections is especially harmful in areas where the results are cheap, but the underlying measurements are noisy. In those scientific realms, the literature may quickly become polluted with statistical flukes. Unfortunately, these two features, cheap results and noisy measurements, are characteristic of most sub-areas of psychology, my own discipline. Some other fields, such as contemporary epidemiology, may have it even worse, particularly with regard to a third exacerbating factor, the small size of the true effects investigated. As Stanford Professor of Medicine John Ioannidis has pointed out, the smaller the true effects in an area, the more likely it is that a given claimed effect is instead a statistical fluke, a false positive. There are fixes, one of which both improves the behavior of individual researchers and dissolves institutional obstacles. Public registration of the design and analysis plan of a study before it's begun. Clinical trials researchers have done this for decades, and in 2013, researchers in other areas followed suit. Registration includes the details of the data analyses that will be conducted, which eliminates the former practice of presenting the inevitable fluctuations of multifaceted data as robust results. Reviewers assessing the associated manuscripts end up focusing on the soundness of the study's registered design rather than disproportionately favoring the findings. This helps reduce the disadvantage that confirmatory studies usually have relative to fishing expeditions. Indeed, a few journals have begun accepting articles from well-designed studies even before the results come in. The Internet's explosive growth has led to pervasive public ratings of and useful comments on nearly every product and service. but somehow not for scientific papers, in spite of the obvious value of commenting for pointing out flaws and correcting errors. Until recently, to point out a problem with a paper in a place other researchers would come across, you had to run the gauntlet of the same editors and reviewers who had missed or willfully overlooked the problem in the first place. Those reviewers, as experts also publishing in the area, frequently have commitments, just as the authors do, to flawed practices or claims. Now, finally, scientists are taking advantage of the Internet to contribute expertise and opinions that go beyond the authors of an article and its two or three reviewers. In October 2013, the U.S. National Library of Medicine began allowing researchers to post comments on practically any paper in biology and medicine via PubMed, the most widely used database of such papers. Correction of simple errors is no longer arduous. Besides simple error correction, comments can provide new perspectives. Cross-pollination of ideas then increases. Exhausted research areas will be revitalized by the introduction of new approaches, and attacks by researchers from outside a field will break hardened orthodoxies. But hiring, promotion, and grant committees typically don't value the contributions made by individual researchers using these tools. As long as this continues, progress may be slow. As Max Planck observed, revolutions in science sometimes have to wait for funerals. Even after the defenders of old practices go to their final resting places, the antiquated traditions sometimes endure, in part from the support of institutional policies. A policy doesn't die until someone kills it. Reforms and innovations need our active support. Only then can science live up to its self-correcting tagline. Replication as a safety net. Adam Alter, psychologist, assistant professor of marketing, Stern School of Business, NYU. Author, Drunk Tank Pink, and other unexpected forces that shape how we think, feel, and behave. In 1984, New York became the first state to introduce mandatory seatbelt laws. Most of the remaining states applauded the new legislation and followed suit in the 1980s and 1990s. But a small collection of researchers worried that seatbelts might paradoxically license people to drive less carefully. They believed that people drove carefully because they worried about being seriously injured in an accident. If seatbelts diminished the risk of serious injury, they would also diminish the incentive to drive carefully. There's a danger that social scientists rely too heavily on the concept of replication, just as potentially careless drivers rely too heavily on seatbelts. When we examine new hypotheses, we tolerate the possibility that approximately one in every 20 results is a fluke. If we run the experiment two or three times and the result is replicated, it's safer to assume the original result was reliable. Students are taught that untruths will be revealed in time through replication, that flimsy results will wither under empirical scrutiny, so the enduring scientific record will reflect only those results that are robust and replicable. Unfortunately, this appealing theory crumbles in practice. As the seatbelt illustration suggests, the problem begins when researchers behave carelessly because of over-reliance on the theory of replication. Each experiment becomes less valuable and less definitive, so instead of striving to craft the cleanest, most informative experiment, the incentives weigh in favor of running many unpolished experiments instead. Journals are similarly more inclined to publish marginally questionable research because they expect other researchers to test the genuineness of the effect. But in fact, only a limited sample of high-profile findings are replicated because there's less scientific glory in overturning an old finding than in producing a new one. Given limited time and resources, researchers tend to focus on testing new ideas rather than on questioning old ones. The scientific record features thousands of preliminary findings, but relatively few thorough replications, rejoinders, and reconsiderations of those early results. Without a graveyard of failed effects, it's difficult to distinguish robust results from brittle flukes. The serious consequence is that our over-reliance on the theory of replication, the notion that researchers will unmask empirical untruths, means that we overestimate the reliability of the many effects that have yet to be re-examined. Replication is a critical component of the scientific process, but the illusion of replications as an antidote to flimsy effects deserves to be shattered. Scientific Knowledge Structured as Literature. Brian Christian, author, The Most Human Human, What Artificial Intelligence Teaches Us About Being Alive. What's most outmoded within science, most badly in need of retirement, is the way we structure and organize scientific knowledge itself. Academic literature, even as it moves online, is a relic of the era of typesetting, modeled on static, irrevocable, toothpaste-out-of-the-tube publication. Just as the software industry has moved from a waterfall process to an agile process, from monolithic releases shipped from warehouses of mass-produced disks to over-the-air differential updates, so must academic publishing move from its current read-only model and embrace a process as dynamic, up-to-date, and collaborative as science itself. It amazes me how poorly the academic and scientific literature is configured to handle even retraction, even at its most clear-cut, to say nothing of subtler species like revision. Typically, for example, even when the journal editors and the authors fully retract a paper, the paper continues to be available at the journal's website and with no indication that a retraction exists elsewhere, let alone on the same site, penned by the same authors and vetted by the same editor. Imagine if the Food and Drug Administration allowed a drug maker to continue manufacturing a drug known to be harmful as long as they also manufactured a warning label, but were under no obligation to put the label on the drug. A subtler question is how and in what manner, caveat lector, to flag studies that depend on the discredited study, let alone studies depending on those studies. Citation is the obvious first answer, although it's not quite enough. In academic journals, all citations attest to the significance of the works they cite, regardless of whether their results are being presumed, strengthened, or challenged. Even theories used as punching bags are accorded the respect of being worthy or significant punching bags. But academic literature makes no distinction between citations merely considered significant and ones additionally considered true. What academic literature needs goes deeper than the view of citations as kudos and shoutouts. It needs what software engineers have used for decades: dependency management. A dependency graph would tell us at a click which of the pillars of scientific theory are truly load-bearing, and it would tell us at a click which other ideas are likely to get swept away with the rubble of a particular theory. Academic publishers worth their salt could, for instance, flag not only retracted articles — that this isn't standard practice is again inexcusable — but articles that depended in some meaningful way on the results of the retracted work. Academic publishers worth their salt would also accommodate another pillar of modern software development: revision control. Code repositories, like wikis, are living documents, open not only for scrutiny, censure, and approbation, but also for modification. In a revision control system like Git, and its wildly successful open-source community on GitHub, users can create issues that flag problems and require the author's response. They can create pull requests that propose answers and alterations, and they can fork a repository if they want to steward their own version of the project and take it in a different direction. Sometimes forked repositories serve a niche audience, Sometimes they wither from neglect or disuse. Sometimes they fully steal the audience and user base from the original. Sometimes the two continue to exist in parallel or continue to diverge. And sometimes they're reconciled and reunited downstream. A Git repository is the best of top-down and bottom-up, of dictatorship and democracy. Its leaders set the purpose and vision and have ultimate control and final say, yet any citizen has an equal right to complain, propose reform, start a revolt, or simply pack his bags and found a new nation next door. The accept, reject, and revise and resubmit ternary is anachronistic, a relic of the era of metal type. Even peer review itself, with its anonymity and bureaucracy, may be ripe for reimagining. The behind-closed-doors anonymous review process might be replaced with, say, something closer to a beta period. The article need not be held up for months, at least not from other researchers, while it's considered by a select few. One's critics need not be able to clandestinely delay one's work by months. Authors need not thank anonymous readers who spotted errors and provided critical feedback when those readers' corrections are directly incorporated with attribution as differential edits. Those readers need not offer their suggestions as an act of obligation or charity, and they need not go unknown. Some current rumblings of revolution seem promising. Wide circulation among academics of working papers challenges the embargo and lag in the peer review process. PLOS One insists on top-down quality assurance, but lets importance emerge from the bottom up. Cornell's Archive Project offers a promising alternative to more traditional journal models, including versioning, and its endorsement system has, since 2004, suggested a possible alternative to traditional peer reviews. However, its interface, by design, limits its participatory and collaborative potential. On that front, a massive international collaboration via the Polymath Project website in 2013 successfully extended the work of Yitan Zhang on the twin primes conjecture, and I understand the University of Montreal's James Maynard has subsequently gone even further. Amazingly, this groundbreaking collaborative work was done primarily in a comment thread. The field cries out for better tools. Meanwhile, better tools already exist in the adjacent field of software development. It's time for science to go agile. The scientific literature, taken as content, is stronger than it has ever been, as of course it should be. As a form, the scientific literature has never been more inadequate or inept. What's in most dire need of revision is revision itself.
The Way We Produce and Advance Science. Catherine Clancy, Assistant Professor of Anthropology, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Last year, I spearheaded a survey and interview research project on the experiences of scientists at field sites. Over 60% of the respondents had been sexually harassed, and 20% had been sexually assaulted. Sexual predation was only the beginning of what I and my colleagues uncovered. Study respondents reported psychological and physical abuses, like being forced to work late into the day without being told when they could head back to camp, not being allowed to urinate, verbal threats and bullying, and being denied food. The majority of perpetrators are fellow scientists senior to the targets of abuse, the targets usually being female graduate students. Since we started analyzing these data, I haven't been able to read a single empirical science paper without wondering on whose backs, via whose exploitation, that research was conducted. When the payoff is millions of dollars of research money, New York Times coverage, Nobel Prizes, or even just tenure, we often seem willing to pay any price for scientific discovery and innovation. This is exactly the idea that needs to be retired, that science should be privileged over scientists. Putting ideas above people is a particularly idealistic way of viewing the scientific enterprise. This view assumes that the field of science is not only meritocratic, but that a scientist is, or where she comes from, plays no role in her level of success. Yet it's well known that class and occupational and educational attainment vary by race, gender, and many other aspects of human diversity, and that these factors do influence who chooses a scientific career and who stays in science. As unadulterated as we may want to envision science, the scientific enterprise is run by people, and people often run on implicit bias. Scientists know these things. Scientists wrote the papers to which I refer. But I'm not sure we have all internalized the implications. The implications for implicit bias and workplace diversity are that social structure and identity motivate interactions between workers, increasing the chances for exploitation in terms of both overwork and harassment, particularly for those who are junior or underrepresented. Scientists aren't blind to the problems of the ways we culturally conceive of scientific work. There are increasing discussions among them of the ever-elusive work-life balance. By and large, these conversations center around personal ways we can create a better life for ourselves through management of our time and priorities. To my mind, these conversations are a luxury for those who have already survived the gauntlet of being a trainee scientist. There are few ways to consider or improve work-life balance when you're one of the grunts on the lab floor or fossil dig. Overwork and exploitation don't lead to scientific advancement nearly as effectively as humane, equitable, and respectful workplaces. For instance, recent social relations modeling research reveals that when women are integrated rather than peripheral members of their laboratory group, those labs publish more papers. Further, years of research on counterproductive work behaviors demonstrates that when you create strongly enforced policies and independent lines of reporting, work environments improve and workers are more productive. The hassled, overworked, give-it-all-for-the-job mentality in science has not been found empirically to produce the best work. The lives of scientists need to be prioritized over scientific discovery in the interest of doing better science. Many of us operate on fear. Fear of being scooped, fear of not getting tenure, fear of not having enough funding to do our work, fear even of being exploited ourselves. But we cannot let fear motivate a scheme that crushes potential bright future scientists. The criteria for scholarly excellence shouldn't be based on who survives or evades poor treatment, but on who has the intellectual chops to make the most meaningful contributions. Thus, trainees need unions and institutional policies to protect them, and senior scientists need to enact cultural change. An inclusive, humane workplace is the one that will lead to the most rigorous, world-changing scientific discoveries.